with Sheikh Yasser Ibrahim, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom.
Oh Lord, here I am, pleading at your door. Send me your mercy, send me your peace, or I am lost for sure. Oh Lord, here I am, yearning for your cure. This humble servant will be diverted from you no more, no more, no
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio. The Spotlight.
Leader of Iran's Islamic Revolutionary Ayatollah Khamenei says what's happened since the 2015 nuclear deal was signed vindicates the fact that the West is not a trustworthy interlocutor. Not much has changed for a complying Iran. The Trump-era maximum pressure policies are still there under the Biden administration that's not even willing to guarantee it won't violate the deal like its predecessor. Washington says the ball is at Iran's court. Tehran blames the U.S. and its excessive demands. Both sides say the negotiations cannot go on forever. In the spotlight tonight will be the fate of the Iran nuclear deal. Stay with us. Let's watch a report first.
The arduous road of reviving the Iran nuclear agreement seems to have come to an impasse. So far, the U.S. has claimed on multiple occasions that it is willing and ready to return to the nuclear accord, but its actions show otherwise. On Thursday, Iran's ambassador to the Vienna-based international organizations outlined some of the U.S. and its allies' demands. Kazem Gharibabadi said the U.S. has demanded talks on Iran's regional influence and its missile programs in return for removing sanctions and fully implementing the nuclear deal, known as the JCPOA. He also noted that the U.S. refuses to comply with Security Council Resolution 2231 that removed the ban on the transfer of arms to or from Iran on October 18, 2020. The administration of former U.S. President Donald Trump sought to extend the ban, but the U.N. Security Council rejected Washington's push. Gharibabadi said the United States has also failed, among other things, to give assurances that it will not repeat its previous behaviors regarding the deal. A day earlier, the leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Khamenei, slammed Washington for its stubborn demands in talks to revive the 2015 nuclear deal, and said the United States had failed to guarantee that it would never abandon the pact again. He said the U.S. once violated the nuclear deal at no cost by exiting it. Now they explicitly say they cannot give guarantees that it would not happen again. Tehran says its mistrust in Washington was vindicated in May 2018, when former U.S. President Donald Trump pulled his country out of the deal and reimposed sanctions as part of his administration's maximum pressure campaign against the Islamic Republic. Now, 3 years after Washington's unilateral withdrawal, U.S. officials claim they're willing to remove sanctions on Iran. But in practice, they're refusing to do so, fueling Iran's mistrust of the U.S.
The ball remains in Iran's court, and we will see if they are prepared to make the decisions necessary to come back into compliance. We are committed to diplomacy, but this process cannot go on indefinitely.
This as Blinken has in the past described the Trump-era anti-Iran campaign as a failed policy. Given Washington's refusal to rejoin the JCPOA, Iran started to gradually reduce its commitments under the deal, citing the remaining signatories' failure to uphold their obligations and neutralize the impact of the U.S.'s unilateral measures. Now, while the resumption of talks in Vienna has been postponed until the new administration in Iran takes charge next month, the fate of the JCPOA still seems to be hanging on American politicians, who have so far shown no sign of readiness in altering their anti-Iran policies.
Welcome to the Spotlight. I'm Behruz Najaf, and I'm going to discuss the Iran nuclear deal tonight with these gentlemen. Journalist and political commentator Mostafa Hoshesh in Tehran. And West Coast coordinator of the Answer Coalition, Richard Becker in San Francisco. Welcome to the show, gentlemen. Let's start with Tehran. Mostafa, the U.S. quit the 2015 nuclear deal under Donald Trump, and that was despite the fact that both Washington and the IAEA confirmed Tehran's compliance. Now, how can Iran trust the Biden administration and go on with negotiations for which Washington is not even offering any sort of guarantee?
Hello, Beresan. Thanks for having me. Well, actually, there is no way to trust the United States. The JCPOA itself displayed to Iranians that they could never, ever trust the United States. It was not the first time, actually. In the past two decades, Iran and the U.S. or its European allies, they have had six agreements, with the JCPOA being the last one. In all these agreements, according to American officials and European officials, as well as in some of them, according to IAEA reports, Iran has been in compliance with its undertakings. And because it has always thought that the U.S. and its European allies are looking for a conflict resolution, while the U.S. and its allies have never complied with the terms of the agreements, because they've just been looking for containing Iran's power, and they have not been looking for resolving the conflict. As a matter of fact, Tehran has only one option. You know, in international relations, when there are treaties, especially if one of the parties is a member of the UNSC, the UN Security Council, then you have to be very watchful, you have to be on guard, and you have to keep the pressure, and I mean, of your power in your hands, because there is no other way to guarantee yourself. Even the congressional approval doesn't work in here. The United States withdrew from over a dozen agreements under Donald Trump. Some of them have congressional approvals, from Iran nuclear agreement to INF treaty to Paris Climate Accord, NAFTA, Transatlantic. It withdrew its membership from UNESCO, and it threatened to discard its membership in WHO. So some of them had the UN backing, the UN Security Council backing, and congressional approval and endorsement, but still the U.S. didn't care because the United States feels that it's exceptional in terms of President Obama, or America first, as Donald Trump said. So they feel might is right. So in that aspect, Tehran has no other way but to make sure that the opposite side is complying with this agreement. That's why Iran has stated and insisted that the U.S. should first remove all the sanctions in compliance with JCPOA, and Tehran should verify it and see if it it's happening in action. Then Tehran would comply with its undertakings, because these undertakings are Tehran's leverage on the United States.
Now to San Francisco. Richard, one of the sticking points is the U.S. refusal to provide guarantee. It won't leave the pad again. Washington violated the nuclear deal, and at no cost, of course, and exited it. So why do you think Washington is not committing itself to a deal by actually offering some tangible sort of assurance or guarantee?
Well, I agree with other guests that even if there are the congressional guarantees, they are not really guarantees. They are seen in Washington as temporary in character, as are all the treaties and agreements that the United States government has entered into with either countries or peoples or agencies that it views as being in opposition to U.S. policies in any way. I mean, if we can go back through the history of treaties in the United States, the hundreds and hundreds of treaties with Native peoples in the continent, which were all regarded as temporary treaties. The withdrawal from international organizations that your other guest mentioned, which are also viewed as being in opposition to U.S. interests or the interests of that particular administration. The real objective of the Biden administration and its foreign policy team, which is really a neocon formation, is to weaken Iran. That's their view, their objective, their goal is to weaken Iran's presence in the region and to find ways in which to do that. So now you have the Blinken-led effort trying to impose new conditions or get Iran to accept new conditions in order to have the JCPOA revived, perhaps only on a temporary basis. And one of the problems here, of course, one of the big problems, and this was a problem with the JCPOA when it was signed, was the uncertainty of what is called the international community over whether or not the agreement was going to hold. Mm-hmm. And the consequences of that were to prevent many companies and financial institutions and countries, governments, from doing much in the way of relaxing the sanctions. There was some relaxation, for sure, but many of them held back from engaging in what is considered, if you can consider it that way, normal trade and normal commercial and trade relations with Iran because of an anticipation, or at least the possibility that the agreements could be canceled by the U.S. government on a unilateral basis at any time.
Now, Mustafa, Blinken is saying that his country is waiting to see what Iran is ready to do or not to do and make a decision. Iran has done what it's supposed to do, hasn't it? So it's the U.S. that abandoned the deal. So how can Blinken say that the court remains in the ball remains in Iran's court?
Well, you're right. Iran has done its part. there's no doubt about that. Iran stayed under the nuclear deal for 14 months after Donald Trump withdrew from the nuclear accord in May 2018 in the hope that the Europeans would at least comply with their undertakings and would make up for their loss. But they never took any action, and then Iran started modifying its undertakings, and it took a year for Iran to go after these modifications, but still it stayed under the nuclear deal. Iran is still under the nuclear deal. It's a party to the deal. But the U.S. has exited the deal, and therefore it's the U.S. that should make up for the wrong actions that it's done. And this has been acknowledged even by other parties to the deal, not just the Russians or the Chinese. The Europeans, until a few months ago, they acknowledged that the U.S. should take the first action because they left the deal and they are still outside, and they've caused much damage to the Iranian economy. But let me tell you, Blinken, the U.S. Secretary of State, is completely wrong and right. He's wrong for the fact that I just said it, but he's right because it seems that the U.S. is very much adamant to do the right thing. So they need a new impetus, a motivation. This could be done by Iran in a couple of ways. It could reduce pressures on the U.S. and give in to the U.S. demands and say, okay, let's go ahead with whatever you give us and you said in the last round of talks in Vienna. Well, Iran has already done this option when it started the JCPOA talks and it signed the deal. It agreed to give some concessions in return for the U.S. concessions, and we know what happened, and the U.S. defied the deal altogether, and it never complied with it. The same is true about the Europeans. And it could also go the other way. It could motivate the U.S. through increasing pressures. And it's already done that once, and it has received a very positive response. Let's remember that when Biden took office, he said Iran's nuclear deal is not a priority. If Iran wants us to prioritize revival of the nuclear deal, they need to reverse their actions in the modifications that they've done and go for a full resumption of their undertakings under the nuclear deal. So Iran never did that. They motivated Biden, but not the way that he desired. They increased the pressure through a parliamentary approval that laid more pressure on the White House through four leverages, and then Biden changed the approach, and in a matter of 3 weeks, he sent a delegation to the Vienna talks. So Iran increased the pressure, and it worked. The same is true this time, I believe, especially with a Raisi administration in office, and especially after all these experiences that Iran has had through, you know, under the nuclear deal with the United States. I believe Iran is preparing to increase pressures on the United States in order to motivate Mr. Blinken and his boss.
Okay. Now, Richard, Iran's leader, Ayatollah Khamenei, had warned already on several occasions that the West wouldn't commit itself to implementing its undertakings under the deal. I didn't even would ask for more. He had warned, if you just give him an inch, I'll take a mile. And that's exactly what happened. You know, instead of trying for Washington trying to return to the deal it left, it's asking for discussing some other stories not related to the nuclear issue, like Iran's missile program and regional activity. Let's have your take on that.
Well, the Trump administration was much grosser. Its foreign policy was self-evidently imperialistic and degrading to other countries. The Biden administration's foreign policy team isn't that way. They're more diplomatic, but it reminds us that of an old saying that diplomacy is perjury. And I think in this case, you know, we can see that it is. That what the U.S. officials, the top officials in the foreign policy establishment in the United States, are pursuing what is essentially the same objective as the Trump administration and many before it, since the time of the Iranian Revolution, that is to bring about regime change, and if they can't achieve regime change, to weaken Iran's influence in a key strategic area of the world. That's what the objective really is. So they're going forward in this way because that objective has not changed. And it will be interesting to see, as Mustafa mentioned, whether or not the increased pressure from Iran will push the Biden administration into an agreement. I should also mention that the Biden administration has continued its extremely hostile, position toward Venezuela and toward Cuba. And despite having said in the run-up to the election that it would go back to the Obama administration's position on Cuba, that has not happened. And in fact, the sanctions against Cuba have been increased by the Biden administration, and that should be a sign of how they stand in regard to other countries they regard as adversaries, meaning Venezuela, Iran, North Korea, etc., China.
And Mustafa, the United States insists to kind of tie and link Iran's missile program and regional policies to the nuclear deal. Now, and Iran says that these issues are not on the table, they are not negotiable. Why should anyone, I mean, nobody would negotiate their deterrence power, would they?
No, of course not. But let's remember that up until 2005, the United States tried every option, and it considered many scenarios and possibilities to do a regime change in Iran. But after a series of developments in 2006, and the rise of Iran's power in the region, they started, developing schemes in order to contain Iran. They realized that they may not do a regime change, and they need to go for introductory steps before they could do that. They needed to contain Iran's power. And when Obama was elected to office, and even a couple of months before that, they had a manual, they had a strategy that was called containment strategy, working through a carrot and stick policy. On one side, they tried to, you know, build Iran's confidence that they are willing for a conflict resolution this time. On the stick side, they used military threats, credible military threats, but of course not action. If action was possible, they would have already done that. But they posed military threats alongside sanctions, a new regime of sanctions that was completely different to the sanctions before or imposed on any other nation, including Iran. And then they hope that they increase the cost so that they could push Iran to talks. Then, in the first step, they hope that they could slow down Iran's progress in each of these three areas of Iran's nuclear industries, Iran's missile power, Iran's regional clout, though it would not stop there once they embrace success as a result of this formula. They would go on and on and on, and they would ask for Iran's drone industries, they would ask for Iran's laser industry, and so on and so forth. When we said that, they were just looking for Iran's ballistic missile containment, but now they are also asking for containing Iran's cruise missile industries in their recent remarks, both Ned Price and
we're running out of time.
Let me wrap it up. Yeah, okay. Let me wrap it up just one sentence. So what they intend to do is good if they go all this way along through multiple agreements, slowing down Iran's progress, stopping it, and then rolling back Iran's power components in all these areas. So one agreement is not good, but they need to have to revive this nuclear deal and continue it in other areas in order to contain Iran's overall power.
Okay.
That's the ultimate purpose.
Okay,
and Iran has realized that they would never allow them to
do that. Richard, we only have 30 seconds. Iran seriously doubts and mistrusts the U.S. intentions. Does it have good reasons for that?
Well, it does. And I would just point out that containment in the verbiage of U.S. foreign policy has always actually been a polite term for overthrow.
Okay. All right. With that, we come to the end of this Spotlight show. Let me thank our guests. We had journalist and political commentator Mustafa Kushchashmi in Tehran and West Coast coordinator of the Answer Coalition, Richard Becker, who joined us in San Francisco. And that's it for this edition of The Spotlight. I've been your host, Behruz Najaf.
Insights into the Holy Quran.
Indeed, this Quran guides to what is most upright and gives the good news to the faithful who do righteous deeds, that there is a great reward for them.
In the name of Allah, the Compassionate, the Merciful, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Assalamu Alaikum. Welcome to another edition of the program, Insights into the Holy Quran, by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hawza Seminary of Qom. Please stay with us.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Hello everyone, dear brothers and sisters. I am Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, and we're with you with another edition of the program Insights into the Holy Quran. In this edition of the program, we'll be discussing the commentary of the 23rd chapter of the Holy Quran, Suratul Mu'minun, or the Believers. Now let's just listen to the related verses and then we'll be back. So stay with us.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim.
In the name of Allah, the entirely merciful,
the especially merciful. It is those who hasten to good deeds, and they outstrip others therein.
Dear listeners, as you have been previously with us, in the latest couple of verses we discussed, the Almighty Allah was talking about the different characteristics of the true believers. The 57th verse started saying that they are always fearful of their Lord, and they are cautious of their Lord. And it continued saying, they are the ones who believe in the signs of their Lord, and they do not associate with him anyone. And the last one was the fact that although they try to do their best and give what they can in charity, their hearts are full of fear that they must return to their Lord. They have to stand before their Lord on the day of resurrection. Now the 61st verse says, أُولَٰئِكَ يُسَارِعُونَ فِي الْخَيْرَاتِ وَهُمْ لَهَا سَابِقُونَ. They are the ones who hasten in good things, and they are the foremost to attain them. Before we get into the commentary points regarding this verse, a couple of points need to be mentioned. The first one is the fact that after the previous verse ended saying مِنْ خَشْيَةِ رَبِّهِمْ مُشْفِقُونَ, it says أُولَٰئِكَ يُسَارِعُونَ فِي الْخَيْرَاتِ. So we could infer somehow that fear of Allah and fear of hereafter makes us hasten to do good deeds. Also, if you would remember, in the 56th verse, where the Almighty Allah was talking about those obstinate people, the ones who thought that their wealth and their children are the signs that they are close to the station of the Almighty Allah, the verses said, أَيَحْسَبُونَ أَنَّمَا نُمِدُّهُمْ بِهِ مِنْ مَالٍ وَبَنِينَ نُسَارِعُ لَهُمْ فِي الْخَيْرَاتِ بَلْ لَا يَشْعُرُونَ. Do they think that when we aid them with wealth and children, we are hastening unto them of good things? No, they do not perceive. And in commentary of that, it was mentioned that some people think that having wealth and offspring are the cause of happiness and would make them hasten in doing good deeds. However, this verse implies that haste in doing good deeds comes from knowledge and faith. You have to have sincerity. Your charity needs to be accompanied by apprehension and not what you imagine is doing good. And contrary to those who are ignorant and conceited think, real happiness, real prosperity are not the things to be possessed by wealth and affluence. Goodness, prosperity, divine favor, they all belong to that group of believers who are qualified with these specialties mentioned from the 58th verse up to now. They always fear of their Lord. They always believe in the signs of their Lord, and they don't associate aught with their Lord.
We hope and pray that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala blesses us with the ability to cover more of His divine
in this
word.
Series of programs, we will inshallah discuss the Holy Quran with a thematic approach.
We will inshallah discuss the chapter.
وتمثل القرآن في أخلاقه وفعاله فيه الفؤاد تعلقا وتلاه في جنح الدجى متدبرا.
The context in which Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala speaks in this verse is the context of mentioning the ills and problems and evils of the people of the book, the previous nations who have received revelation, and more particularly the Jew.
Now let's listen to some of the verses of the Holy Quran.
First, let's listen to a few verses.
Now let's listen to some verses of the Holy Quran.
Wa
Insights into the Holy Quran. By Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hawza Seminary of Qom.
So, the true believers are outstanding in their morals and their beliefs. So, they are the pioneers in doing good deeds. This specialty that they hasten in doing good things is not to be seen separated from the other characteristics of the true believers. They were the cause to this fact. So the verse says, وَهُمْ لَهَا سَابِقُونَ, and they are the foremost to attain them. These couple of verses have an obvious and an interesting logical progression that describe the attributes of this special group of believers. So first, it starts with the fear of Allah, and this is the motivating factor that makes them submit to Him and negate all forms of polytheism. And it ends with having faith in the day of resurrection and Almighty Allah's court of justice, which causes us to do good deeds and to take responsibility for the quality of those deeds. The Quranic word yusari'una means outstripping others in speed. This interesting word expresses the state of believers who race in competing for a great and precious objective, and indicates the kind of relentlessness of the competitors in acts of goodness and righteous deeds. So one of the signs of the true belief in the Almighty Allah and true faith is that speed and that competition we have in ourselves to doing good deeds as the first ones. Thank you, dear listeners, for staying with us. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Don't be saddened by what you see, by all the lies and treachery. Life is cruel, but don't worry. In your heart lies the key to unwind all the secrets. This life we see.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English, for listening to us. If you have any question regarding our programs, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Also, visit our website at parstoday.com. Until the next program, take care. Goodbye.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Thank you.
Live reporters.
Palestinians accused Israel of using unjustified deadly force against Palestinian children in the occupied West Bank. In its latest report, Defense for Children International Palestine stated that the Israeli soldiers continue to kill Palestinian children with no recourse or accountability. In its report, DCI Palestine revealed that evidence it has obtained shows children killed didn't pose any threat to the Israeli soldiers at the time of their killing. The group says that Israeli forces used lethal force against Palestinian children in circumstances that may amount to extrajudicial or willful killing.
Killing unarmed minors amounts to war crime and even crime against humanity. Israeli soldiers act in line with shoot-to-kill policy, opening fire to kill Palestinian children. The troopers know their military establishment will hold any of them accountable for killing innocent Palestinians.
On Friday, a 17-year-old Palestinian boy, Mohammed Tamimi, was fatally shot by live ammunition in his back during a peaceful anti-settlement protest that was held in Nabi Saleh town, West Ramallah. Meanwhile, on Monday, a 17-year-old Yusuf Nawaf Mhareb, a resident of the Ramallah area village of Abwin, succumbed to wounds he had sustained a prayer when he was shot in the neck by Israeli forces during a protest against Israel's aggression on the Gaza Strip. Experts say that under international law, the use of lethal force during a protest is allowed only when a direct and lethal threat to life or of serious injury exists. And as usual, Israel continues violating international law, including rules which limit the intentional lethal use of firearms, in particular against children.
Israeli forces have a twofold purpose by targeting Palestinian children. First, they want to intimidate Palestinian children to prevent them from taking part in anti-Israeli activity. And second, to oppress the Palestinians in general, to impose and strengthen the Israeli military control.
Since the beginning of the year, 10 Palestinian minors were killed in the occupied West Bank by Israeli forces using live ammunition. Palestinians accuse Israel of using unjustified force against their children. They even warn that Israeli soldiers will continue killing children in cold blood as long as they won't face inquiry. Mona Kandil, occupied Ramallah.
Speaker of Iran's parliament, Mohammad Baqir Qalibov, has met Syria's President Bashar al-Assad in Damascus. Assad said that Iran is a main partner for Syria, which offered its support in all sectors. He asserted that ongoing coordination for fighting terror had a positive impact on the ground and will continue until the liberation of all Syrian territories. Qalibov said the Syrian and Iranian people's determination to participate in the recent presidential elections in the two countries proves the failure of policies of pressure adopted by their enemies. Qalibov held a separate meeting with his Syrian counterpart, Hamoud Sabbagh. He said military and political relations with Syria are currently in their strongest and best form, expressing willingness to enhance economic cooperation with Syria.
After their failure in military war against Iran, the Zionist and U.S. regimes have waged an economic war against us. Our joint priority now is to achieve development in our countries, improve our economy, restore the infrastructure, and increase the bulk of mutual trade exchange.
Sabbagh referred to the high level of coordination between parliaments of Iran and Syria, affirming that the two countries stand together in the resistance alliance, working to eliminate hegemony and colonialism, which their enemies are imposing on the region.
We held a very special and important meeting for further coordination between both parliaments through consultations and the exchange of expertise. We also agreed on activating the work of our friendship committees in the two parliaments for the benefit of the two peoples.
Speaker Qalibov also held talks with Syria's Prime Minister Hussein Arnous. They underlined the importance of expansion of economic cooperation in both public and private sectors for facing economic sanctions, as well as the siege imposed on the Iranian and Syrian people. The exchange of visits between Iranian and Syrian officials reflects the strong historic ties between the two countries. There has been a noticeable development in economic, political, military, and parliamentary cooperation since the start of the war on Syria, which represents an alliance both states are strengthening to counter U.S. and Western pressure against them. Hamad Ali, Damascus.
Sheikh Ibrahim al-Zazaki and his wife.
Addressing the press, a member of Zazaki's defense team said the Kaduna State High Court discharged and acquitted Sheikh Zazaki and his wife Zinat of all 8 charges in a ruling that lasted for several hours. The judge ruled that the prosecution has failed to establish any case against the leader of the Islamic movement in Nigeria and his wife.
The court ruled that the charge ought not to be in the first place. You cannot arraign a man for an offense that was allegedly committed, as at the time the said crime was not an offense. And the court was very emphatic in that yes, the Kaduna State government has powers to enact laws, but they cannot enact laws to prosecute an offense retrospectively.
Sheikh Zazaki and his wife Zinat were arrested in December 2015 following an attack on his home and worship center by soldiers of the Nigerian army, which resulted in the killing of hundreds of Zazaki's supporters. In a statement, the Islamic movement said the judgment is a vindication of Sheikh Zazaki and a victory for truth and justice against tyranny and oppression.
The events of December 12th and 15th of 2015 were orchestrated by state machineries who are using the instrumentalities of state apparatus to fight a religious fight. It is strictly, the events of December 12, 2015, is strictly a fight between Shiites and Sunnis, fights that was imported from Saudi Arabia for whatever purpose.
The Kaduna State High Court has set Sheikh Zazaki and his wife Zinat free. The Islamic movement, and indeed many of Zazaki's supporters, have expressed happiness with the outcome of this judgment. Benjamin Abdullahi, Kaduna.
Thousands of Ethiopian refugees crossed the Sudanese borders on Monday, arriving at Taya village at Basunda locality in Gadarif state. Reports say the refugees is considered the biggest number of refugees to cross into the country in only one day since the outbreak of war last November in Tigray region. Many believe that the wave may worsen security and humanitarian situation in the region due to armed conflicts erupting at western area of Ethiopia.
Sudan has adopted an open-door policy in receiving Ethiopian refugees since the beginning of the conflict. So far, Sudan has welcomed about 75,000 to 80,000 refugees. We call on the international community to help us meet the needs of the increasing refugees fleeing from the fight in the Tigray region.
Since the beginning of fighting, tens of thousands of Ethiopians have sought safety in Sudan. But conditions in Sudan refugee camps are presenting new challenges, as Sudanese NGOs early responded to humanitarian situation in the state affected of refugees influx.
Actually, since the crisis of the refugees started, the Tigray crisis started, Sudanese Red Crescent has been present from day one. And that is basically because we do have our ongoing activities in the region through our branches in Kassala and Gadarif. So we do have ongoing programs for the already existed old refugees in the area. So with the beginning of the crisis, we were already on the ground.
In the light of the latest development in the Tigray region, UN agencies strive to maintain a strong staff presence, provided there is access in Hamadayet in case there is an increased influx. Several partners continue to remain on the ground in anticipation of this possibility.
Security and health challenges face Sudanese and Ethiopian governments to cope with increasing number of refugees. Khartoum says it is still waiting for international support to tackle the crisis. Muhammad Ali Fazari, Khartoum.
And now
Algerian judoka athlete who made headlines last week for shunning an Israeli opponent at the Tokyo Olympics has now been temporarily suspended along with his coach from the International Judo Federation, meaning that Fethi Nurin will not be able to compete after making his bold statement in support of Palestine. After returning to Algeria, V secured an exclusive interview with Nurin to ask why he felt he had to walk.
I was pitted to play against an athlete from the usurper entity occupying Palestinian land, a regime which kills innocent people and drives them out of their homes, day and night. Because of this, I don't accept that my hand is smeared with someone who represents an entity like this, and for his flag to be associated with the Algerian flag, which is in support of the Palestinians' cause.
His actions meant he would miss out on a chance to win a medal, but Nurin admitted he had no regrets.
If the same situation arises, I would not hesitate to take the same decision. The world needs to know that Israel is an occupier and they practice all kinds of laws that deviate from the international laws and human rights. We need to send a message to the world that we deal with all religions with dignity, just as the Islamic religion recommended us to do. Except for the ones who fight against the religion and the Muslims. We are against them and it's our rights to respond to them. We have the right to defend our religion and all oppressed Muslims.
The Olympic Charter takes a strong stance against any political acts, stating that no kind of demonstration or political, religious or racial propaganda is permitted.
However, this isn't the first time that a Muslim athlete has protested against this controversial lineup. Many are now starting to ask questions about the Olympics and their lack of sensitivity on the subject. Also, are the games being used to whitewash Israel at a time when Palestinians remain deeply oppressed? Robert Carter, London.
More and more people in the EU are congregating indoors. The highly contagious Delta variant of COVID-19 is spreading like wildfire in countries like France and Spain. More people are also travelling within the EU. Citizens in Brussels have been sharing their thoughts on the Delta variant.
I don't know where the cases come from, if it's a coffee restaurant or just meeting in our house.
When I see how people are behaving sometimes, I'm not surprised.
The European Central Bank, which manages the euro, says economic confidence is being undermined.
The pandemic continues to cast a shadow, especially as the Delta variant constitutes a growing source of uncertainty.
On Monday, EU finance ministers rubber-stamped COVID-19 recovery funding for four additional nations in the 27-country bloc.
Croatia, Cyprus, Lithuania and Slovenia. Now more than a half of national plans is adopted.
However, critics say the billions of euro being administered to national governments will result in citizens being saddled with decades more austerity because there is too much emphasis on loans rather than grants. According to analysts, EU leaders are harming the bloc's economy through their foreign policy. Sanctions are inhibiting trade. Economists say the Iranian market represents a big opportunity. It can be availed of if current efforts to save the JCPOA-Iran nuclear deal succeed. We have been speaking to the head of the European Parliament's Iran delegation about the subject via Skype. She believes the agreement will be reinstated soon.
Many people in Iran say, again and again and again. We have not a good partner on this side. This is one of the impacts of this horrible, stupid policy of Trump.
The International Labour Organization, ILO, warns an additional 25 million jobs could be lost globally before the end of this year due to the coronavirus. However, the ILO says if we see an internationally coordinated policy response, the number of people losing their jobs could be much lower. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Lebanese Prime Minister-designate Najib Mikati said he hoped he can regain the trust of the people and the role of the state. He also vowed to meet with President Michel Aoun regularly in order to speed up the formation of the new government.
There was full unanimity on demanding swiftness in the formation of the new government. And after today's session, I briefed President Owen on the outcome, and I always visit the presidential palace in order to achieve the government's formation as soon as possible.
Mikati spoke after a day of non-binding meetings with Lebanese lawmakers who stated their views after separate consultations. Free Patriotic Movement declared it will not be taking part in the next government, but will offer all the necessary facilitations and support for a quick formation.
We're starting from scratch. We're starting something new, no baggage. No one is carrying any historical disagreements between the parties. That's what we heard from the designated prime minister, and we hope that that will be reflected in the coming future, within hours or days at least, that this will make a difference.
Prime Minister Designate stressed that he has the foreign support necessary to begin economic reforms. One member of parliament told Press TV that when they asked about this support, Mikati stressed that France has given him assurances that after the formation of the cabinet, they will give all assistance to resolve the financial and economic crisis. However, this assistance will not be without interest.
No foreign country would give assistance for free. It has its own interest in mind as well. It's only natural when France gives aid to Lebanon, it has ambitions. If France assists in rebuilding the port, it could be the main future authority in the port of Beirut and could be managing the trade and commerce from Europe to the entire Arab world. If it rebuilds the electricity sector, it will also be a good investment for French companies. And at the same time, Lebanon is in drastic need of that assistance.
The main concern for all sides is salvaging the country's economy, which has been described by the World Bank as one of the world's worst since the 1850s. After initial meetings with lawmakers, the real political bargaining begins for the formation of the government. This in itself could prove to be controversial, with Mikati stressing the need for keeping to the French initiative, opponents stressing the need for adhering to the National Charter of Confessional Representation. Mariam Saleh, Beirut.
The British government has decided to expand blanket stop and search powers under a new plan to beat crime. Measures unveiled on Tuesday include changes to police powers to allow searching people without suspicion in areas where they believe violence could break out under the Section 60 Criminal Justice and Public Order Act.
Across all stop and searches powers, black people are 9 times more likely to be stopped than white people. But under the Section 60 Act, that rate is even higher at a whopping 18 times. Moreover, the research data shows that in 99% of Section 60 searches, no weapon is found.
Press TV got a reaction to this story from Charles Critchlow, former president of the National Black Police Association. He said,
"This government has abandoned any pretense of a desire for a fair and just society, particularly insofar as black people are concerned. First of all, the efficacy of such an approach is not proven. Moreover, it's counterproductive in that it alienates the community when the support of the community is critical."
His thoughts were echoed by Suleiman Lee, a community activist from Black Child Promotions, who himself has been harassed by the police.
There's always going to be conflict at street level. There's disorganized crime, then there's organized crime. And as I said before, black youth cannot facilitate any criminal underworld. They can only participate. A lot of black youth, they're serving time, even though we're 3% of the population, according to the 2011 census, we're disproportionately represented in the prisons at Her Majesty's pleasure.
The government announcement came 2 months after the Criminal Justice Alliance, a network of 160 organisations, called for the power to be repealed, arguing that Section 60 had led to thousands of innocent people being unnecessarily stopped and searched every year, with the number of searches rising from 622 in 2016 to 2017 to more than 18,000 in 2019 to 2020. It seems unlikely that Priti Patel will bow to pressure from campaigners, after already dismissing the criticisms levied against the plans, much like she dismissed the sentiments behind the Black Lives Matter protests that swept throughout the UK. Ahmed Cabello, London.
On
On the occasion of the Eid al-Ghadir, Iran has officially begun vaccinating prisoners across the nation against the COVID-19 virus. Speaking at the vaccination ceremony, Iran's deputy health minister said that in view of the existing capacity and availability of vaccines, all prisoners will receive the first dose of vaccines in the next 10 days.
In view of the existing capacity and availability of vaccines, all prisoners will receive the first dose of vaccines in the next 10 days. Thanks to the proper observation of health protocols by prisoners, the average number of people infected with the virus in prisons has been less than ordinary people.
In the past couple of days, with the imports of foreign-made vaccines and the entry of domestically produced vaccines into the vaccination basket of the country, the pace of vaccination process has increased to the extent that, according to the Iranian health minister, the country has set a record of vaccinating over 430,000 people on a single day.
In the occasion of the auspicious Eid al-Ghadir, we have begun vaccinating all prisoners across the country. To vaccinate all prisoners and those working at prisons, we need over 200,000 doses of vaccines. This amount has already been supplied, and the vaccination process for prisoners will continue as planned. At today's ceremony at Evin Prison, in Tehran, 250 prisoners were among the first to receive the jabs.
Moreover, centers for drive-in vaccination across the country have been established, and they have played a major role in the increase in the daily vaccination rate. Iran is using a combination of locally produced vaccines and imported foreign-made vaccines in its national vaccination program. According to Iranian health officials, the country's homemade coronavirus vaccines develop immunity against the new mutations of the virus.
According to Iran's health ministry, almost 60 million Iranians will be vaccinated against the virus by the end of the current Iranian year in March 2022 using domestically produced and foreign-made vaccines. Saman Kujuri, Tehran.
Limelight. London-based Advanced Pharma and its subsidiaries were found to have charged excessive and unfair prices between 2009 and 2017 for leothyronine tablets, primarily used to treat hypothyroidism, which affects at least 2 in every 100 people and can lead to depression, tiredness, and weight gain. We're prepared to an article written by Rob Davis under the heading Drug Firm That Hiked Prices by 6,000% Paid Shareholders £400 Million. The article has been published by the British newspaper The Guardian. Pharmaceutical firm that inflated thyroid drug prices by up to 6,000% over a decade paid out more than £400 million to shareholders and directors during the same period. London-based Advanced Pharma and its former private equity owners, HG Capital and Cinven, were fined a combined £100 million by the Competition and Markets Authority, CMA, on Thursday, 29th of July. Advanced Pharma and its subsidiaries were found to have charged excessive and unfair prices between 2009 and 2017 for leothyronine tablets, primarily used to treat hypothyroidism, which affects at least 2 in every 100 people and can lead to depression, tiredness, and weight gain. Patients have told how they were left with no option but to pay private doctors for prescriptions and forced to hunt for cheaper tablets